In the 1969 movie, The Italian Job, Michael Caine played a thief who hacked the transportation control system of Turin, Italy, to cause a traffic jam so he could rob an armored vehicle full of gold. Of course, in the 60s, there was no internet, so in order to hack the transportation system, he had to physically drive to where the system was located, break down the door, knock out a few cameras, and then his hired hacker changed a security tape reel, and finally, traffic around the city came to a screeching halt. The idea of hacking a transportation system, even back in 1969, by physical force is a startling example of just how far technology has come and the vulnerabilities that come with that progress. Today, unlike in 1969, taking advantage of these vulnerabilities is something that can be done remotely from anywhere in the world. A hacker can hide in the shadows, maybe in their own basement, or even hack away while sipping a cocktail on the beach thousands of miles away. With the right set of skills, hackers have potential to cause damage from a distance, the ultimate unseen enemy. And as we enter a new area of transportation automation, where a car you buy today may have more lines of code than even a Boeing 787, this increased dependence on software opens up a lot of vulnerabilities. In order to protect ourselves and the systems we use daily, we've got to stay one step ahead of potential security threats from these dreaded hackers. Thankfully, there are people out there shoring up our defenses to help minimize the risks so that we can ride around safely in our connected cars with all our privacy and data protected. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, the VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens Digital Industry Software. And for this week's episode, we're pausing our Women Driving the Future series to bring you a special episode on cybersecurity. We're going to look at cyber vulnerabilities that open up as cars and transportation become more complex from a software standpoint, especially with connected and autonomous vehicles that are driving up software content at an ever-increasing rate. With the greater potential for transportation cyber threats comes a greater need for transportation cybersecurity. And with us today is Slava Brofman, CEO from Cybellum, a startup that assesses cybersecurity threats for companies developing software for the automotive industry. He is a perfect person to talk to help us get an idea of how cybersecurity, connected and autonomous vehicles are all coming together, and all the cybersecurity issues that need to be addressed as our transportation future unfolds. Slava, welcome to the Future Car Podcast.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you for having me here. Excited to be here, talk about this fascinating topic.
Well, you came upon cybersecurity and the need for cybersecurity based on your experience that in part was with the Israeli Defense Forces. That was your previous job. Could you tell us a little bit, what's it like to work for the Israeli Defense Forces?
When you talk about the Israeli Defense Force, it's very different if you talk about cyber unit or technological unit and combat soldiers. So, you know, to be in a fighting forces, so it's pretty much similar, I guess, to any army in the world. But that's not something that I did. I was part of the Cybersecurity Intelligence Corps. And in a sense, you know, it's very much similar to any other technological corporation in the world. Obviously, you know, you start in the army, you do the basic training and everything and all the kind of military duties, which vary. But eventually, once you get to your unit and usually, you know, in many cases, you are not even wearing uniform, just, you know, working with the latest technologies, you know, solving some great challenges, cybersecurity challenges, adopting software. The army today, at least in Israel, adopting software development methodologies. So for me, I served actually in the army for almost 6 years. I was an officer and so on. It was like going to a great workplace, work with, you know, in a very young environment with very talented people. They are kind of cherry-picked by the army.
There's a traditional army, like you mentioned, and now it's evolving, where cybersecurity is a key piece of that. How does that change what security forces have to do? How important is cybersecurity becoming relative to, say, more traditional army or the traditional forces?
Yeah, you know, interesting that our general of the Israeli army was a couple of times quoted saying that the next battle or the next war won't be a physical war. It will be definitely a cyber war. And we're definitely getting prepared to that. I know in the Israeli army today, what you can do with cyber means, it's a lot more powerful and easier than what, you know, you need to do with traditional forces, getting, you know, to some foreign countries and so on. You can just from your computer somewhere remotely or, you know, in the center of Tel Aviv, control other countries' facilities and so on. It's definitely changing. And
it's hard to see the enemy. You don't even know where they are or if they're coming or what they're going to do, right?
Definitely. You know, it's a different kind of enemy. They're getting through the bits and bytes and through your software, right? It's a completely different type of enemy. And it's harder to defend probably from this kind of enemy. It's just you need to think of there are no kind of clear borders of what you need to defend.
Well, so if you have, and you've touched on it, you have the offense and then the defense. I would imagine to do a good defense, you have to think about what the offense is going to do. Are they similar? Do they think in different ways? Do you have to think of yourself as, hey, what would that hacker do to get in, to figure out how to make that best defense?
Yeah. Actually, Ed, you know, thinking about the difference between offense and defense, they're completely different. So different, you know, attacking is both easier and actually I think also kind of a lot more rewarding, if you will. You know, eventually if you are an attacker and thinking like an attacker or like, you know, an offense cybersecurity, you only need kind of to succeed once, right? You only need to find one hole, one vulnerability, get in, and that's what you need. Unlike defenders, if you're a defender, you need pretty much, you know, to defend everything. There is no like, I only will lose in one, in one battle. You need to win all battles. Otherwise, you lose the war just by losing one battle. That's also if you defend, you know, your success is if nothing happens, right? This is success for you if you are doing defensive cybersecurity. However, if you are doing offensive cybersecurity, you kind of seeing results immediately, right? If you are successful in your operation or whatever, you are kind of being able to penetrate some network, get out information and so on. It's like a puzzle or kind of enigma that you need to solve. I guess in that sense, again, they're very much different. You know, cybersecurity, like from a defense perspective, it's all about processes and technologies and people that perform, you know, a full kind of operations. But attacking, you know, offensive can be a lot more like freestyle, right? You need to be a lot more creative. You can just, you know, just need to find one path to get in. So it's completely different in that sense.
You have the hard job. You got to always, your boss is going to get upset if one time they get through and it's a big one. Do you have an example? You called it a puzzle. And when you think of it as a puzzle, it almost becomes fun in a way, trying to solve the puzzle. Can you give us an example of one of the more complex or maybe surprising puzzles that you had to solve?
Yeah, you know, that eventually when you need to, if we're talking about cybersecurity, right? When you, attackers, all attackers, I guess like everyone, eventually they're lazy, looking for the low-hanging fruits in a sense, right? So when you are doing kind of an operation or trying to hack a network or some IoT device and you try to break it and get in, eventually you can, you know, you can work on a project for months or, you know, sometimes there are projects that you work for years to try to get into some kind of network or something. And almost always, you know, from my experience, you get to something that is very kind of stupid that the other side kind of missed, like a default password or some open port in a network firewall or something like that. It's always the, you know, the small things, some leftovers in the code that, you know, the developers left just for debugging. And eventually you find them out in the production environment. So you're always looking, you know, when starting some kind of an operation like that, you're always trying to think, okay, this is the network, this is the device, maybe we'll find some cool vulnerabilities, then we'll need to find some exploitation to that and so on. But, you know, in many, many cases, in most cases, I think that I saw it's eventually getting down to a very small mistake the other side did. Default passwords are always fun to find, very easy. You know, once you get the password, you're in. Yeah, so usually there are tons of examples like that people left things, you know, for the development environment and eventually pushed it to the production environment. They have everything encrypted, but there is just one device, one printer eventually that is communicating to the network without any encryption. All the firewalls, everything is very hardened, but there is one VPN, that they legacy VPN that they left behind, that they, you know, it's fully vulnerable and they forgot
to close it. The missing piece, right?
Exactly, exactly. It's always the missing piece, yeah.
It's exciting when you're doing a puzzle and you can't find that piece, right? You have a big pile of pieces on the table and you finally find the one that fits in there. So it's probably the same feeling, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's exactly like that. And again, eventually it's something that you think, oh my God, I should have seen that, you know, the first day when we just started this.
Well, the next time you'll find it right away, of course. But then there'll be a new piece that you can't find. That's the way it works.
Yeah.
Now, it's an interesting career. You go from the armed forces to a startup in cybersecurity, which I would think is somewhat unique. How did that unique experience in the defense forces help prepare you for creating a startup in the cybersecurity area?
It's interesting that in the Israeli army, first of all, if we talk just about cybersecurity, you know, specifically, I personally think that in Israel, for of course, the army is the best cybersecurity school and the best cybersecurity training you can get, probably one of the tops in the world. So in terms of, you know, just understanding the basic of cyber, there are usually training programs and onboarding programs that last nearly a year for every new soldier that getting into those forces. And so you get, you know, and there are decades of best practices already built today in all these units are there from the 90s, from the early 90s. So there are great practices around that. So you learn cybersecurity, but I think moreover, something that you learn in the Israeli army, at least in the, you know, in the cybersecurity units that I was part of, is you learned about problem solving, widely talked in the unit, that always saying that technology is just one means to solve, you know, problems. The most important thing is you need to find what is the real problem and not just to play, you know, with technology. And moreover, that there is always a technological solution. Like there is no question if something is possible. It's always a question, you know, of time, resources, and so on. But it's always possible. Once you define the problem, well define the problem, there will be a technological solution to, you know, to solve this problem. So I can give you an example where there is, you know, some discussion or some meeting and you are asked to bring a solution, technological solution to something. There is no one expects you even to come and say, yes, it is possible. It's of course it's possible. Or you just need to come with a plan that says how long it will take me and how many, you know, people or men I need for that. So I think this kind of thinking, if the transition from the military, from the Israeli army to starting the startup, I think it's very, very helpful. So, and being a founder of a startup in Israel that, you know, that served in the Israeli army for many years, it's not unique. I think most of the Israeli startup founders are, you know, did their military and the cybersecurity units in Israel. And I guess it's not only the cyber, it's this kind of thinking that that helps and make it successful.
Now, as an entrepreneur, because I was a founder myself of a startup, and there's always an interesting story about that moment when you said, oh, I should start a company to solve this problem. When did that inspiration come? When did the light bulb turn on that said, I've got to start a company?
Yeah, so, you know, interesting that I this moment came that I said I need to start the company before I had any idea of what the company is going to be about. I actually started it with who is my co-founder today and used to be actually my commander in the army.
Yeah, I'm Michael
Engstler. Yeah, he's the CTO and he used to be my commander in the army. Same is true for many of the other employees that we have today.
When you were in the army and he was your commander, did he ever, like, for instance, say, hey, you do 20 push-ups because you messed something up? You never make him do that now, right, if he makes a technology mistake?
No, definitely not. And again, you won't see any do 20 push-ups or something in technological units. It won't fly in these areas.
Only mental exercise.
For sure. That's exactly, you know. It's interesting that even, you know, the army today is fighting for talent. You know, they try to keep cybersecurity people as much as they can in the unit. So there are not like punishments or stuff like that. It's all about, you know, tech.
Hard to recruit everybody that you need.
Very hard, very hard, very hard to recruit, you know, smart people, especially when there is so many opportunities out there.
At very good pay, too, I would imagine.
For
sure.
So
it makes it very competitive.
It's widely discussed in Israel, all the international companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google, and others are opening R&D centers in Israel and paying crazy money for talent that, of course, the army cannot compete with that, with those salaries. And it causes an issue in Israel.
So you and Michael put your heads together, it sounds like, and decided it was time.
Yeah, it was just when Michael got discharged from the army after, I think, also about 7 years or so. And we met for a beer, and he said, and he came to me, and it was his idea. The credit is, you know, to him. Let's basically start a company that will automate what we've been doing for the last so many years in the army manually. And that's actually how Cybellum started. You know, the entire vulnerability detection and hunting today, in most of the world, is happening manually, where security researchers are, you know, sitting, reverse engineering devices and trying to find vulnerability. And we started Cybellum to try to automate this entire process. And that's kind of was the initial thing.
So it wasn't necessarily just for autonomous vehicles. It was more vulnerability in general.
Yeah, exactly. We actually started and we did a pivot about 2.5 or 3 years ago to the automotive sector. But we started as a general vulnerability detection solution, at least the initial idea. She's solving problems even for the IT world. About 2 years or a year and a half after we started, we met a guy who used to be the head of car security in Daimler Mercedes. He used to run the entire car security practice, was reporting directly to the CEO of Daimler, Mr. Ronen Lago, and he basically took us to the automotive world, presented us, you know, his challenges today, what is his challenges to run, you know, the security program across all Daimler. He presented us actually the supply chain in the automotive sector, which I found fascinating, that to know that, you know, they are called car manufacturers, but they're actually not manufacturing anything.
Supply chain is very, very big.
Yeah, and it's so complex. And actually, if you look about software-based components, it's usually 100% of the software-based components are produced by the tier one, tier two suppliers, and so on. Yeah, so basically, this guy who is today part of Cybellum's advisory board, taking active part in Cybellum, is he showed us the automotive sector, and then we focused on automotive.
Can you give us an idea of a typical vehicle cybercrime?
Yeah, so probably, you know, you would imagine what you see in movies, that hackers are hacking cars and driving them off bridges and so on. But fortunately, it's not the case yet. Hopefully, it will stay like that. So we see today a lot of cybercrime around vehicle theft, like stealing cars. Most of the, in some developed countries, most of the vehicle theft today is done by remotely, you know, by hacking the smart key fobs or the mobile apps that are today, you know, able to open a vehicle, start the engine, and so on. Actually, you cannot even come today, you know, to modern vehicles and, you know, play with the wires like we saw in Gun in 60
seconds. Yeah, hot-wiring the car.
It's not possible anymore because you need to start all the software systems and all the technological systems. The car is a data center on wheels, right? For these vehicles, we see a lot of car theft that is done like that remotely. So this is one thing, you know. And the other thing is stealing data. Today, a vehicle stores enormous amount of data about you, how you drive, where you're going, you know, your GPS, your location. You're pretty much storing, you know, your credit card details inside your infotainment system, you know, to pay for all the services and apps like, I don't know, like Spotify and Netflix and others that you have on the vehicle, or to pay for, you know, for the electrical charging station. You're not no longer getting out of the vehicle, paying with the credit card or going, you know, to the cashier. So we see this kind of attacks today. We think of other examples. We saw now, I think over a year ago, a smart car alarm that it was breached. The interesting part about smart car alarms that they are getting so much functionality in the vehicle today that once you breach them, you have full control over it. So, for example, they are recording the voice inside the vehicle, like if there is something, you know, some accident and so on, so they can react to that. But just think if someone is breaking, you know, the application of this smart car alarm, you can get all the talks that you can, you know, listen to in the vehicle. And this is, you know, a great violation of privacy. But moreover, something that is also that is unique to those car alarms, that they can turn off the engine just because it was traditionally designed to be kind of a safety feature, to stop stolen cars. So just think today.
Yeah, you're going down the highway and suddenly your engine turns off.
Exactly. And this was a hack of some, I think it was called the Viper car alarm system and Pandora in the UK. They were both hacked and basically given the full control for attackers to control the vehicle. Something that you wouldn't imagine. It's just my mobile application to my car alarm. But from that, you can take a full control over the vehicle.
We worry about cyber attacks on our laptops for all the reasons you just said, right? It could be your credit card information or other information you don't want to share. But now you're adding a physical element to that, like you just said, could turn off the engine and endanger your life directly. How much of that is actually occurring now? Or is it still mostly cybercrime where you're trying to get access to a car to steal it or get information? Have they been successful in doing, for instance, what you just said, turning the engine off to try and cause harm?
Yeah, so look, in terms of white hackers or doing that for research purposes or just kids that are doing that out of curiosity or because they are bored and they're very talented. So yes, definitely there are a lot of proof of concept for that. Going back to 2015 where Charlie Miller hacked the Jeep. There are many examples about researchers doing that and driving vehicles, remotely out of the road. For that, there are a lot of examples. However, we still haven't saw any real world hacking and, taking over physical damage to the vehicle. I think, this happens because of mainly two reasons. One is that, frankly, still most of the vehicles around the world are not connected.
But that's increasing, though.
For sure, that's increasing. And in a few years, you won't have not connected vehicle. But I think the other thing is motivation for to drive a car outside of or to take a physical control over a vehicle. You probably need to be some, terror attack or something like that. But the true motivation of hackers today is financial. They try to get to the data, right? They try to get to the credit card and other financial data that is stored in the vehicle. They are trying to get to all the accounts that are stored and so on to steal vehicles. But I think today there is no motivation for just hackers other than terror attacks to get physical access and control vehicles. But I do think unfortunately, it's a matter of time. There will be some compelling event in this industry that will kind of flip the entire industry upside down.
You're hearing all the time people hacking into one place or another. At what rate is this increasing?
It's exponentially increasing because it's just getting easier. Again, as we progress, the selling of new connected vehicles is exponentially growing, meaning today it's really hard to buy, for example, in Germany and other places, a vehicle that is not connected. So just if you're an attacker, the attack surface is bigger for you. So this is growing exponentially and together with the tools to hack a vehicle. So today you can go to the dark net and the dark web and just buy out of the box tool or a service to hack a vehicle.
Oh, that's scary. That sounds scary.
That's for sure. It is scary. It is scary. And it is scary to drive today a car, an old car that don't have all the safety mechanisms and drive a car without a safety belt. It's pretty much the same for cybersecurity. It is scary for new vehicles, connected vehicles. They can be easily hacked.
Well, not to scare people more, but if you go back, 10, 15, 20 years, the number of connected vehicles was very small, if almost even non-existent. What's the percent of vehicles that are connected now? And how's that going to change, say, in the next 5-10 years, you think?
Today, the amount of connected vehicles, it's very, very low in the single digits, probably around the world. There are, countries like Israel, unfortunately, that we still don't have connected vehicles just because of regulations. We have new vehicles and just they are, the connectivity is cut off before bringing the vehicle to Israel. So regulation is actually a big driver for that, to increasing that. Once you open up the regulation, happens in most countries, like in Europe, in the United States, and so on. So we'll see more and more than that. So I do expect that the regulation will change in just a couple of years. You know, it's a matter of 2 to 3 years once the entire world will accept connected vehicles. And once that happened, you know, to get to 20, 30, 40, 50% of vehicles that are connected will be relatively easy. In 5 to 10 years, we'll see that probably most of the vehicles around us will be connected. Just think that every year there are about 100 million new vehicles that are sold. So in that pace, and every new vehicle is already connected. So in that pace, we'll see, you know, most of the vehicles around that are connected.
What's the benefit of having your vehicle connected?
That's basically the future. Having your vehicle connected is like getting all the services that, you know, that you want.
Netflix, whatever it might be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you just sit at the back seat, you know, your kids sitting in the back seat of the vehicle, and you don't need anymore to bring them your phone or your tablet or whatever. There are screens and they can just, you know, stream directly their Netflix, or every kid can listen to their own Spotify or whatever. You are getting your maps and maps updated directly in the
vehicle. Ask Alexa a question, whatever it might be.
For sure. You know, that's great. Just, you know, you see today the new vehicles and you just say, whatever you want, where you want to go and so on. You just communicate with the Alexa of the vehicle. And today there is the Alexa Auto, which is actually a great and amazing addition of Alexa for vehicles.
How is it different, the Alexa Auto versus the one in your home?
So they are basically, I would say, trained, you know, the machine learning algorithms of them is trained for different type of commands and for different types of operations. They're not just, you know, ask them on the hour or so on. They actually, you need to ask them where to drive, where is the best way and so on. So they're trained for that. They are trained, you know, to understand what is the speed of the vehicle, to adjust various functionalities that they have, to work and display things on the vehicle screens, which are today becoming, you know, covering everything that you have in front of you just becomes a big LCD screen or LED screen today. So this is great. And moreover, you know, if we talk about connectivity, it's not just a single vehicle. There is all the, you know, the V2X practice when you communicate with the traffic lights, with the vehicles around you.
V2X, that's vehicle to X, which would be vehicle to anything. What is the anything?
Just replace X with almost any letter and you will get something. Like, I mean, V2V, it's vehicle to vehicle, and you can communicate with the vehicles, you know, around you. So if the vehicle in front of you is just stopping suddenly, so you will get notification about that, and you will also, you know, your vehicle will slowly stop as well to avoid crashes. Communicating with traffic lights, right? So you know exactly when the traffic light going to get red or so, so then or green, so then the engine can start again, you know, with the new vehicles that they turn off the engine while waiting in the traffic light. And there are so many other functionalities that will just make the driving experience amazing, like a real experience. And, you know, the entire movement of paper mile versus paper car, changing this entire world. So,
you know, one thing I don't think I like about this is it sounds like if Alexa knows my speed and how I'm driving, she's going to become like another backseat driver telling me what to do and, you know, turn the wheel. This could be worse than the cybersecurity threat.
Definitely. You will have some new assistant that will tell you every time that you'll pass the limit.
Well, as long as they still have the off button, we'll probably be okay, I would imagine. You've mentioned that to solve this problem, there's layers of security. It's not just in the vehicle. It has things to do with the supply chain, all the other systems that back this up. Can you tell us a little bit what you mean when you say the approach to security involves understanding all the layers that go into operating a vehicle, making it connected, keeping it on the road, keeping it safe? Tell, what do you mean by these layers?
Sure. So I think just of the IT world, right? It's the same practice in cybersecurity, I guess, across all verticals, across all sectors. If you look at the IT world, so you have like in our organization, you have the organizational network and you have the, you know, the laptops, the servers and so on. So just think of the layered security there, right? You have the antivirus on your endpoint, right? Or in your laptop. However, you still have the cloud security to protect all the apps and your access to all the applications, to the cloud applications like Gmail or whatever Dropbox or whatever cloud applications you are using, and they're still in the organization. There is a firewall to protect, you know, on the organizational level that no one will get inside. And there are, you know, different solutions for the encryption key management systems and so on. So it's always a layered approach. And that's because you have also basically layered networks or layered phases in a network of an organization. And it's pretty much similar in a vehicle. Eventually, a vehicle today has a couple of internal networks inside, which there are a lot of computers that are connected to that. And moreover, of course, you know, there is one thing to protect a single vehicle, but there is another thing to protect a full fleet of vehicles, right? So again, if you think about the same analogy like to the IT world, when I say a layered approach, it means that you need, first of all, to understand what are all the access points to your vehicle, starting very early on from your, you know, supply chain. Do you protect your supply chain? How you can validate that your supply chain is protected? Next, you need to understand that there is in the automotive world, there is a very long cycle of development. Until the vehicle is getting to the road, it takes like 3 to 5 years. So you need to protect this entire cycle of the development. And of course, there is the entire manufacturing. So in the manufacturing as well, you need to put, you know, security measurements to make sure that in your manufacturing facilities, everything is protected. And then once you get to the vehicle itself, so you still need to have some endpoint protection, right? On maybe on each ECU, on each computer in the vehicle, because if someone is eventually going to get to one of their computers, to one of the ECUs, they need to be protected and have some antivirus or anti-malware or some other protection on them. Then you have the network in the vehicle. You need to put some firewall or what is called the IDS, the intrusion detection system, to protect, you know, or to detect anomalies, to perform anomaly detection on the vehicle network level. And then you need to protect the everything that's connected to, you know, from the vehicle to the cloud, right, to protect this area. And the last part is, of course, you need to have some control measurements around your entire fleet, like how you can monitor your entire fleet, how you can react if someone is attacking your vehicle, how you can monitor your vulnerabilities, and many, many other aspects that are actually also today mandated by the regulation and standards today in this industry.
My first reaction to what you just said, it seems like, oh, there's so many pieces to this puzzle. All you have to do is find a weakness in one of them, and the whole chain falls apart. So you have a system of systems. Where do you think the biggest weakness is? The vehicle, the back end, something in between? What's the first thing you'd want to look at, or what's the first thing you think needs to be improved to help increase cybersecurity?
Yes, I think there are two things that are absolutely essential. The first is design, right? If you design the vehicle not in a secure way, there's pretty much nothing you can do at a later phase. If the vehicle is designed in a way, for example, that you can get from the external connectivity or from your Wi-Fi connectivity or something like that directly to your brake system and to the safety zone in the vehicle, so there is, you know, only so much that you can do to really protect it. So design is a key. Okay, secure design of the vehicle is a key factor. And the other part is actually supply chain, mainly because this is how this world, you know, works. That again, as we discussed before, there is a very long and complex supply chain in the automotive sector. Most of the components today in the vehicle are developed by third parties, not by the OEM itself. Usually this is the weakest link. Every supplier have their own security practices, and eventually you as a big OEM, you are dependent on the security practices and security level of each of your suppliers, you know, separately. So eventually you need to find, you know, the weakest link, the weakest supplier that didn't implement the security measurements. The other interesting part is that all the entire industry is using the same suppliers, right? So once you detected the vulnerability in a component of one supplier, most likely that you will able, you know, to reproduce the attack on other vehicles of other brands and other models and so on.
Find the weakest supplier and get in through that. It would be hard enough, I would imagine, to do this if you're the vehicle manufacturer in your own company. And now you're saying, I have dozens and dozens of these suppliers out there. And you want to make sure that they're as secure as you are. And you're going to do your best to be 100% sure that you're secure. And in order to do that, I would think you'd have to have your suppliers be almost an open book. Here's everything I have. And they might be reluctant to do that. Is the cooperation there that needs to be there to make a vehicle manufacturer feel confident that their supply chain is as secure as they need to be?
So you definitely would expect that that would be the case, that they will just give you everything as a supplier, even give you access to the source code and present you all the security mechanisms and hardening that they implemented. But actually, it's exactly the opposite. Today, the suppliers, and I think this is the, just, you know, traditionally how the industry works. They supply a completely closed black boxes of, you know, component, just a black box closed component supplied to their customers, which are the OEMs. The OEMs are traditionally know how to do, you know, the safety crash test and so on. Where you don't need any, you know, visibility into each product and integrated to the vehicle. So the industry, in terms of the relationship between the OEMs and the suppliers, is still acting like the components are not connected and like there is not, you know, a huge cyber risk. Today, the regulation is changing that. It still is not enforcing, you know, the suppliers to kind of open the kimono and give the OEMs visibility to what is inside. But it is mandating the all the suppliers and the entire supply chain to perform certain cybersecurity analysis, cybersecurity activities, to perform ongoing monitoring of new vulnerabilities, of new attack techniques, of new threat intelligence, and so on. So probably, you know, regulations, standards, and actually requirements by OEMs. And actually, we see more and more like that. The tenders from OEMs today are coming with a very clear, very specific cybersecurity requirement that each supplier need to meet. Otherwise, they just cannot play in that industry.
So regulation is the way to do that. It's no different than regulations for crash.
Right.
That would be safety from a mechanical standpoint. So now regulations from a software standpoint. There is a regulation out there, WP29, right, from the, I think the United Nations put that together. Now, is that helping do this? Is that an accepted standard that the supply chain and the car manufacturers are working to?
Yeah, and actually it's a great initiative by the United Nations that they came up with a regulation with very little, I would say, cooperation from the industry itself. They just came up with a regulation and they understand the threat and said, moreover, that it's not only applicable to OEMs and suppliers that are in the EU, but actually it's applicable to any vehicle that eventually will run on European soil, meaning that it's pretty much applicable to any manufacturers around the world because they are also probably selling to Europe. And you can just think about the expectation in the automotive industry that this WP29 regulation would do the same transformation like we saw what GDPR did to privacy, right? So, you know, GDPR started in Europe and it's actually European regulation, but today...
GDPR, what exactly is GDPR?
I remember the acronym, but it's General Data Protection Regulation. It's the biggest regulation in Europe, or I guess the main regulation in Europe about what you need to do with data that you store and any personal information that you store. And it's kind of became a synonym today to data privacy. So thinking of data privacy today, no company can collect data without meeting, you know, the GDPR compliance. And all the, you know, the annoying cookies, notification that you get and once you log into websites, this is thanks to the GDPR, right? It's a bit annoying to see them every time popping up when you surf to a new website, but it's really helpful for all of us to, you know, to keep our privacy and keep our data private and not give, you know, companies to share our data with others.
So it's like an anti-cookie regulation for cars in a way. It's an extension to that level.
In a way, it's something similar that if you need to understand that if you're going to sell a connected vehicle, a vehicle that is based on software, which is every new vehicle today, you must meet WP29. It's kind of coming together. Again, similar to what you mentioned, Ed, before with functional safety. If you are selling the car today, you know that you need to meet the safety regulations, and it's becoming the same with cybersecurity.
Let's talk about the two aspects of this. There's the need for cybersecurity when you're developing the vehicle, And let's say you develop it perfectly just for a second. Then you put that vehicle on the road. And now even you feel that it's perfect and now it's out there. Then there's going to be issues with cybersecurity related to it operating. So first, from the engineering standpoint, as the software's become so complex, especially with autonomous vehicles, we have these massive data sets that you're training the AI algorithms on, or you're using subroutines that you've gotten from, say, open source potentially. It would seem that there's so many places where someone could sneak just a little tiny thing in there and cause you a problem. I imagine that's a big worry for your customers.
For sure, 100%. That's a huge worry and that's a huge challenge. You know, there are so many, as you mentioned, there are so many moving parts. There are so many pieces of code in a vehicle, and you need to make one mistake. That's why, again, coming the layered security, that even if you do this one mistake, you will have other security security mechanisms to stop the attack. It's a huge challenge. And that's why our opinion is that the only way to cope with this challenge is automation and technology, because, you know, just trying to go over everything manually and making sure that you haven't entered some kind of malicious piece of code or did some mistake or left your default passwords or a development password in the code that eventually someone can hack you, or just you took some piece of open source code from the internet and used it in one of your in one of the vehicle computers. It cannot scale. You can do it, you know, once for one specific component, but actually if you really want to do it across all the vehicle and all the models and all the variants, you know, for each vehicle, there are so many versions and variants that are going for different geographies and so on. And each one have different code and different suppliers and different open source. The only way to cope with that is very strict processes that are very strict engineering processes that tell you exactly what you can do, what you cannot do, and how you need to document everything, and technology that will do the governance for you.
But, you know, you can't really talk about cybersecurity and processes without mentioning SolarWinds and what happened here in the United States. And in that case, I believe that they had their processes set up, but somehow they were able, the cyber threat was such that they could get in there. And at the even though they checked everything out and it seemed like everything was perfect, right at that last minute, right before the code went out, they slipped that thing in there. It's almost like, over here in the United States, when we have Halloween and trick or treat and all that, you know, when you're growing up, they say, always be careful. There might be something sharp in that candy bar, razor blade or something like that. And it's almost like you check the candy and everything's perfect. And right before they seal the package, after all the checks, boop, they slip something in there. So how do you protect against that?
Yeah, actually, again, this is a great example that to what we discussed before. An attacker needs to find one pass inside, all right? And that's exactly what happened, you know, as you mentioned, in SolarWinds. It is challenging, right? There is no silver bullet to that. And there is no 100% in cybersecurity. There will always be this kind of risk. And eventually, you know, a very persistent attacker would be able to get in. You cannot protect against everything. You should do the best effort that you can, right? Especially to be, again, not to be the low-hanging fruit for attackers. You know, like the old saying goes that you don't need to outrun the bear, you need to outrun your friend, right? So you need to make sure that you as a brand, as a vehicle manufacturer, you won't have silly mistakes during your engineering and development. And you will perform the best practices and best effort and hire and have real budget for that. That's another challenge in the industry that today, you know, cybersecurity, they treat cybersecurity only as cost. It's only costs for them, you know. Every dollar that goes to cybersecurity makes the vehicle less profitable. And it is a challenge, right? It's just doing your best effort, putting more budgets, hiring more people, using, you know, more technology inside from the very early stage of design throughout the entire vehicle lifecycle, which is 15 years, and validating every piece of that, every piece of your supply chain, every piece of your internal development, monitoring post-production, yeah, all those practices.
You know, it's interesting because we're always willing to pay for an option, like a bigger screen or something like that, but we expect the vehicle to be safe. And if added cost goes into that, what's going to happen? The price of the vehicle may go up unless somebody figures out a way to do that in a more economical way. So that's going to become a greater and greater point of competition, I would imagine, as to what car manufacturer can do that most efficiently and most securely in the future, especially as it becomes a bigger and bigger problem. So that was the development side. So now your vehicle's out on the road, and it's going to rely on, like you said, V to X. So vehicle to infrastructure, vehicle to, for instance, you want information on from GPS, you want information on traffic lights, you want information from other vehicles. Even if you have the perfect secure system, now someone could hack the information that's going into that perfect system. How do you protect against that?
Just pointing out all the challenges. So look, I give you even a more kind of extreme scenario. You know, if you look at autonomous vehicles today and they're having all the cameras and radars to read the traffic lights and to read all the traffic signs to know how to drive, right? So just think that there are cameras today, and we already saw a couple of attacks like that you just put a kind of transparent sticker on one of the traffic signs, right, that says like a stop sign, and you put a sticker on that says like, I don't know, that the speed limit is 100 miles per hour or whatever.
Anything but stop, right?
Anything but stop. And if a human being cannot see this transparent sticker, but the camera of the vehicle, for sure, it's exactly the pixels that they are reading and working with. So it's a completely new attack vector. It's a completely new attack vector that you are completely not familiar with from any other industries. There are no practices how to deal with those kind of attack vectors. This is exactly what today security engineers and product security teams and vehicle security teams in all the automotive OEMs are starting to learn. What is the attack surface? What are the new attacks? What are the challenges? How we solve them? Cybellum, for example, is coming with a solution that is composed of what we call the cyber digital twins, that we can create a digital entity of each component in the vehicle or the vehicle as a whole, and to do the simulation of all those attacks and different attack scenarios and different attack techniques on this digital entity, again, to help them both to constantly be able to test new things, because testing new things on hardware and creating full kind of testing beds and scaling across all the variants that we talked about before of vehicles, it's pretty much challenging. My solution to everything is eventually technology, processes and technology. That's the only way.
Now that we've built up this big threat and got everybody worried out there, I'm anxious to hear how Cybellum's going to solve this. But one question before we do that: autonomous vehicles, and people are, they're becoming more accepting. There's a lot of PR out there, but you're trusting a computer, right, to drive your car. So you have to overcome that. And now we add on top of this the whole cybersecurity threat. Do you think that if you put all this together, that people are ever going to accept autonomous vehicles? Feel comfortable driving in one?
Yeah, I remember the quote from Elon Musk that remember he said about he was asked when autonomous vehicles will be allowed to be on the road, and he said that it won't be the case. The case will be the cars that we drive today will eventually be outlawed because of the amount of accidents and so on. And I think that will be pretty
better than the human driver, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's pretty much the same would be with cybersecurity. Eventually, a car will be hackable and attackers would be able to hack them. But you will probably accept the risk just because it will be, just a statistical thing. Autonomous cars will be a lot safer than regular cars today, again, because
It'll
of the human factor. It will take time. It will take time. But once we'll have enough autonomous vehicle on the road and, the entire V2X communication, vehicle-to-vehicle communication will be mature enough, there will be a lot safer than cars that we drive today. And the same for cybersecurity. There will be still risk, and we probably will be able to accept the risk. We'll do, new things that we are not doing today. We'll buy insurance. We'll buy cyber insurance for our vehicles. That will happen for sure. Other stuff, like if you think of safe vehicles today, you probably see, you think of Volvo, right? Volvo, the safest vehicle in the world. We'll have the same brands for cyber. There will be some brand that will be considered more cyber secure than others, and it will be definitely, you know, a factor when we will decide what brand we're going to buy. We're going to buy the most secure brand.
An important feature to evaluate.
For sure, definitely. As far as we'll get more technology inside and we'll decide, okay, we want this very, you know, connected and full of screens and whatever services inside vehicle, we'll also think together with that, what is the cybersecurity of that? And in the dealership, you'll have the, you know, the dealers are telling you exactly how secure is this vehicle and what security mechanisms that are inside and how the vehicle before production was, I don't know, validated with Cybellum and the Cybellum services protecting the vehicle post-production.
Yeah, like 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, these interior features and the Cybellum rating of X, right? That's
exactly.
The future.
That's the future. That's the future.
Now, let's talk about Cybellum. And you mentioned a few minutes ago the cyber digital twin, which is a key part of what you do. First, could you just explain what is a digital twin generally? And what is it specifically when we talk about a cyber digital twin? And how does all that fit in to doing what Cybellum does, trying to make autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles more secure?
Yeah, sure. So digital twin is a, you know, is not a new concept. It's been around for a couple of years now already. And digital twin is eventually a digital replica of a physical device. So you can think that we use a lot of digital twins in the energy and the manufacturing area where you create a digital twin of some systems or some smart meters, you know, and you do that some kind of emulation in some digital environment just because you don't want to create, you know, the physical piece every time and you want to do some tests and emulation on a digital entity. And it's mainly used today, many use cases like predictive maintenance that you want to do some prediction on the digital device or on this digital, I don't know, manufacturing IoT device before really updating the physical device that, just to understand how it's going to react. You do some analytics on these digital twins. And again, they are identical replicas of the physical devices but just running in a digital environment.
So if I have a digital twin, it could be faster or lower cost to actually do a test on the digital twin than it would be to create the real physical item itself and run that test on the physical item. So you could do development faster, say, or get your final tested device out the door faster if you have a digital representation of it that's very, very accurate.
Precisely. Exactly. That's exactly the case. That's why it used it, why it was invented. Just because you cannot scale with hardware every time, if you really need to create a physical device for every, you know, new variation of something that you wanted to do, perform testing. Another example is actually autonomous vehicles that are using a lot of digital twins for simulation, right? You create a digital twin of your ADAS system or some other system in the vehicle, and you do simulation of different autonomous vehicle scenarios. And you run it on a digital entity because you cannot run the vehicle in the field or on the road and to test all these scenarios. So you're doing that using digital twins. That's another example.
So cyber digital twin.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yes, actually, it's a trademark of Cybellum, cyber digital twins. And we took, so we understand the challenge that we discussed today of the scalability and how many moving parts are there, how many moving variants and how hard it is to really, you know, to cope with all those challenges on a physical environment and so on. So we took this digital twin concept to the cyber world. You know, there are each digital twin, a digital twin is a complete area. Like there is no single digital twin. And for each kind of use case, you have its own digital twin. So when we take this, the digital twin to the cyber world, we basically create digital twin of physical component that encapsulates inside all the characteristics or all the parameters that are needed for pretty much any security analysis. So I'll give you an example. So if tomorrow you want to test some vulnerability and understand, is it applicable to this device? Can this vulnerability be exploit this device? Or there is new attack technique. Can I simulate this attack technique on this device? So a cyber digital twin actually gives you the platform to conduct all those kind of analysis without the need of the source code of the device, because again, you cannot get access to the source code in the supply chain kind of environment. And also you don't need the hardware. Everything is digital. This is a digital entity, a digital artifact, and you can simulate everything there. And just, you know, to give you a sense, it has inside everything from the bill of materials, what this component is composed of, what are all the hardening mechanisms, what are all the encryption mechanisms, what is the business logic inside, what are the control flow, what internal components are communicating with other internal components, and we do simulation of everything. All security analysis tasks, security validation, and so on are performed on this digital entity. And again, not needed the physical component.
So imagine I'm a car manufacturer and I give you a casa slava. I need you to help me make my all the software systems in my car secure. And you're going to do it with this digital twin. How do you create it? How do you create a digital twin? I would imagine you have to know about a lot of the details of all the software that's not only in the car, but all the software systems that are going to interact with the car. That seems like a really big task.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is. It is a big task. That's why, you know, Cybele has been around for almost 5 years developing this solution. So we are getting, first of all the software of the vehicle and getting it usually from backend systems that OEM are already maintaining, usually PLM systems like Siemens PLM solution that we are integrating to, and getting all the software that is eventually in the binary format of that is eventually getting into the vehicle. The security, the product team can actually create the vehicle structure or model the vehicle structure in Cybele system to exactly say what component is communicating with which component, with other components, and how, and also connected to all the kind of backend or other applications like the mobile app and the key fob and so on. So by integrating to backend systems and getting the binaries or the firmwares of all the components that are in the vehicle, the user, Cybele's user, can actually model the entire vehicle and then basically perform all the security analysis that they wish.
As a car manufacturer, do they come to you at the very beginning before they even write the code? Or is it more, okay, here's my system, and now you test it out?
So it's a mix. Cybele today sell a product. The product is eventually installed on the customer servers. And they use it today for both. You know, our recommendation is, of course, to start with systems that you even haven't, as you said, haven't written a single line of code, to make sure that eventually they will be secure. But life is life, and there are already cars that are on the road or just before SOP, just before production, and you need to make sure to validate their security as well. So it's a mix, and today it happens for both.
If I'm sitting there coding, does it give me feedback and say, hey, wait a minute, you've made a mistake here. Make sure you consider A, B, or C. Does it work like that?
Exactly. For every piece of, for every new version that you upload, it can be just the development version, you get a full list of what are all the vulnerabilities, what are all the threats and risk and weaknesses that you implemented into the code, what are, you know, the best practices that you missed. Eventually there is the cybersecurity policy of the organization. Like, and if I'm Ford, Daimler, or whoever, I have my own cybersecurity policy. Once you code something or do something that is out of the policy, you get exactly, you know, a report of gap analysis. What are the gaps from the organizational policy or some industry policy? And also, what are the gap resolutions, a recommendation, a step-by-step kind of guidelines of how to fix things and what are the best practices. And actually, we also focus a lot on education to not only give you the explanation, hey, change this flag to this, but actually, why? What's the reason behind that? Because, you know, we understand that that the developers of vehicles today are not cybersecurity experts, and it is important for
educate as you develop.
Pretty much so. Yeah, it's very important in this industry to create this awareness and to explain, you know, what is the root cause, what is behind our recommendation, why we think this is better. This will eventually lead to better software build or more robust and secure software.
You know, we talked early on about offense and defense. And in order to have a good defense, you got to understand the offense. And the hackers are always figuring out that next best move. How do you stay ahead of the hackers?
It's a challenge. First of all, as you said, you need to think like an hacker. You need to think like an hacker and not just like as a defender. You need to think like one, constantly, read and being up to date with all the new attack techniques. something that is constantly evolving. You need to stay up to date with a lot of the things that are happening in the darknet, because, you know, many of the things are starting there. So you need to be on top of all this threat intelligence and new attack techniques, new attack mechanisms, and so on. But even if you do so, eventually an attacker can be one step ahead of you. So I think that the only way that you can do that is going kind of to the basics and focus on the root cause of things, right? To create a secure design, kind of design a secure vehicle, things that, you know, won't change in a year or two. You need to create, you know, to just fix vulnerabilities as they occur and not just put more and more security mechanisms and hope that no one will find out those vulnerabilities and no one will find out your default passwords or open ports or whatever mistakes you made to the code. So I guess, you know, really fixing issues from the root to detect the root cause of stuff, fixing it and not just, you know, do some workarounds. That's the only way that you can keep up with attackers.
Always vigilant. Always have to be ready. Have you ever hired, or is it worth hiring people that used to be hackers, since they're the ones that know how to do it? Do you do that?
So if it's a white hat hacker, or what we call an ethical hacker, or someone that, of course, doing hacking for the Israeli...
Someone you can trust.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is a thin line, but it's an important line. Once you cross this line, we don't want to deal with this in Cyberlin with, you know, with ethical things. And as long as you're on the right side, that and doing, you know, if you are in a hacker, that
just hire the good guy hackers.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But yeah, definitely. A lot of the team in Cyberlin is today composed of people that did hacking during their military service and so on.
Maybe to close out here a little bit, staying ahead of the hackers that are out there, and that's one of the main goals here. What can you tell all our listeners that will put them at ease? That if you're using the digital twin, the cyber digital twin, if you're working with Cybellum, that, hey, everything's going to be all right. What can you tell us sort of to close things out and let us know everything's going to be all right?
General, I'm a positive thinker, and I believe that everything is going to be all right. That's for sure. And I can tell you that there is a lot of new regulation that is coming up. All OEMs and all tier ones are adopting this kind of regulation. So all cars that are all connected cars that are going to be in a year or two now will follow a very strict cybersecurity practices, cybersecurity processes, and each component, each piece of code in the vehicle going to be validated against for cyber threats and for cyber risk and for various weaknesses. So this is happening as we speak, and this will only increase. So, you know, the guys that are manufacturing our cars are taking care of that and are thinking about that. The other part is that more and more vehicles today are secure, are really secure by design. And this is starting, meaning that even if someone is breaching, hacking your car, it's really hard to get to the safety zone, meaning to what's really controlling the physical aspects of the vehicle. And the other part, again, I'm an engineer, so everything getting down to numbers. So statistically, it is still safer than driving a vehicle. The amount of accidents that we see because of the human factor are a lot bigger than what we will see, even if there will be a lot of cyber threats or cyber attacks. So I guess we are still in a good place.
Well, listen, thank you so much for giving us such a great overview of the problems and also, you know, how we can address some of the issues related to cybersecurity. Before we finish, though, we'd like to end with our rapid fire section. And it's a series of quick questions. Some general questions about the automotive industry, some questions more about what you do when you're not working, let's just say. You can give me a quick answer if you want. If you want to pass, you can also so pass. And if you're ready to go, we can get started. You ready for rapid fire?
I am ready for rapid fire.
Ready as you can, if you're ever going to be. Okay. So what was the first car you ever bought or owned?
I had a very old car. Like, it was a small Fiat, an Italian Fiat, model 1992. It was barely driving. Yeah, it was when I was a student.
A model 19? I don't think I've ever heard of that. Is that like a 500 or something even smaller?
Even smaller. It's a bit bigger, but it's like square car. It was the Fiat Uno. The model.
Uno. Well, hopefully it ran most of the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah. The older Fiats teach you how to fix cars. Did you pass your driver's test on the first try?
I want to think so, but I remember it was the second. Actually, it was the second.
Oh, what happened on the first try?
I'm still convinced that the tester was wrong, and I was okay. It was about the it was a parking spot that I needed to get in, and he said that I did it wrong, but nothing serious.
It was the test. It was a problem with the test.
Yeah, the tester. Yeah.
Have you ever gotten a speeding ticket?
Actually, I got this kind of speeding ticket just a couple of months ago, but it was driving an electronic scooter. I was driving on the sidewalk in Tel Aviv and was a bit speeding. And also, it's not really allowed to drive on the sidewalk. So, yeah, I got this kind of ticket for that.
You didn't hit anyone or anything,
No, never.
So do they have, in Israel, do they have police on scooters that chase down the speeding scooters? Is that how it works?
They don't chase you down. They just, you know, they know the strategic places that they can stand at, and they just can't just stop you there. And they are taking advantage of, you know, some corners and stuff like that.
In the future, when we have autonomous cars, we like to say they're going to be like living rooms on wheels. Let's say you're about to take a 5-hour trip in the future in your living room on wheels. What would you have in your living room on wheels? Describe it to us.
I always imagine something maybe even simpler, but I always imagine like a business class, like we have in airplanes today, that it's going to be very much similar. You have your bed, you have your screens, you have a small mini bar, you have everything equipped, you know, for a 5 hours drive that you can just take off and do whatever you want in these 5 hours, you know, lean back or work some time, and you have your Wi-Fi and connectivity and everything. Yeah, so I always imagine this kind of business class, like in airplanes model, that we'll have in the vehicle.
Now, on that 5-hour car ride, what person, living or not living, would you want to spend that ride with? If you could have anybody you want in the history of the world.
In the history of the world. No, so actually, I'd actually go for Elon Musk. I think this guy is amazing. He's so creative and think that he thinks about and, you know, and envision and imagine how he also executes and how he managed his time and how he built these great companies, you know, just asking him, you know, a couple of questions and, you know, discussing with him the future of mobility, the future of humankind. It's
Well, here's your chance. If you had one question and only one that you could ask Elon, what would you ask him? You only have 10 seconds to figure out what it is.
To ask Elon how he can really manage all these companies and come up with all these creative ideas and manage his time and manage, you know, still to create some kind of work-life balance and everything in 24 hours.
What car best describes your personality?
Oh, that's a tough one. Maybe electronic scooter. Also an electronic scooter, you know, to be an agile and drive on the sidewalk.
Yeah, there you go. Quick turns, get through the small spaces. Perfect. All right. We're going to shift gears just a little bit. What's your favorite spy book or spy movie?
So just, you know, The Spy with the new one with Sacha Baron Cohen that is playing the Israeli spy in Syria, Eli Cohen, just comes to mind. I'm not sure if you saw it, but it's a great one.
What's your greatest talent not related to anything you do at work?
Snowboarding. I'm really good in snowboarding. I love it.
Have you been snowboarding in the United States?
Yeah, in Lake Tahoe. It's a great place.
Ah, yeah, that's great powder out there. We could do another interview about snowboarding. We'll save that for another time.
Okay.
What do you wish you were better at?
I'm really trying to get better in yoga. I practice it for quite a while now, and I'm still so-so.
What do you wish you understood better?
I'm always, you know, fascinated and curious about how we think. So maybe psychology, you know, the interaction between the logical and the emotional and so on. It's very interesting.
If you could have an answer to any question, what would that question be? Besides the one you asked Elon Musk.
Yes, I really want to know who is behind Bitcoin. The guy who is Satoshi Nakamoto, who has really created this thing.
If you could uninvent one thing, what would it be?
I would uninvent the microwave. I don't like it. It ruins food. It's not helpful at all. I would uninvent the microwave for sure.
And here's the last question. If you could magically invent one thing, what would that be?
Yeah, very trendy to say vaccines or something, but they're already invented. Maybe in the, you know, in the context of our podcast, I would say that vehicles that are just working and running on air, you know, no fuel, no electricity, nothing, both to help with all the, you know, global warming and so on, but also probably one of the biggest challenges that the entire industry is.
With that, you have solved all the world's problems.
For sure. That's in the vaccine and we are good to go.
Slava, thank you so much for joining us on the Future Car Podcast. It was really fun learning about cybersecurity and a little bit about you and like you said, solving a lot of the world's problems here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was really fun and thanks again.